We are living through strange days. Across Britain, Europe and America, societies have become split and polarised, not just in politics, but across the whole culture. There is anger at the inequality and the ever-growing corruption, and a widespread distrust of the elites. Yet at the same time, there is a paralysis, a sense that no one knows how to escape from this. Even in America, where there is now hope with the new president, there are also fears that despite the growing crisis, the system will just return to normal. This paralysis is also fueled by a technology driven by the aim of giving you today another version of what you had yesterday. And never a different tomorrow. These films are a history of how we got to this place, and why both those in power and we find it so difficult to move on.
We're talking about power, Chucko.
Well, I know you are. You wouldn't be here.
Oh, look at that.
Yes, sirree.
It heard the word power and it responded just like we do.
They will trace different forces across the world that have led to now. Not just in the West, but in China and Russia as well. And they are told in a different way. They are an emotional history of what went on inside the heads of all kinds of people. Because in the age of the individual, what you felt and what you wanted and what you dreamed of were going to become the driving force across the world. And to understand the present, you have to go back and see what happened when those hopes and dreams and uncertainties inside people's minds met the much older forces of power. Often power that was decaying and desperate to keep its ascendancy.
You really are a problem, sir. I suppose we'll have to put you up.
Going up!
Can you hear me in there? Okay, let's shoot him up.
Why should all the junk pass through the hands of the junkies? That's what I want to know. I mean, how much junk do you need before you can turn on?
It depends on your metabolism.
Listen, you use your common sense. It all helps, but the more junk you have, naturally, the more efficiently the collectors can operate in your neighborhood. If you don't have enough junk of your own...
You go crazy.
No, you form a neighborhood pool.
Yep, yeah, what is this? This sounds a bit extravagant.
Well, no, you dig.
You have to have a pool. Why do the junkies have to have pools? We give them dope, for God's sake.
Because of the hummingbirds and the moles on the bushes, that's why.
Who couldn't swim anyway?
Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride?
Put this blimp down and let me off.
Blimp! Do you think this is a blimp? Manny!
Call him Tiki, Mr. M!
Show our amigo what Miss Gilda can do.
I can see the great ship Hindenburg now. The majestic hulk hovering here over the mooring pylon. There's still a hint of rain in the air. The wind seems to be coming up a bit, and there's the ground crew. Like ants running out to man the ropes. The huge ship is only about 100 feet overhead. And I can see tiny people waving through the windows. Wait a minute. Oh, my God. The ship is heaving over to the left. There's a big gust of wind. There's a spark there. And it rights itself. And it's come around now. The last of the ropes are being secured and... Wow, here come the passengers. There's Judge Crater. And look, Amelia Earhart. There she is. Jimmy Hoffa. How about that? Well, a few of the other passengers, you know, goose-stepping to get the circulation back in their legs after that long transatlantic flight. But that is the story here from Lakehurst.
These strange days did not just happen. We, and those in power, created them together. In the late 1950s, as the British Empire was falling apart, there was a growing sense that something was badly wrong under the surface. There was a feeling of unease, that despite all the reforms after the Second World War and the welfare state, the old forms of power had not gone away. And neither had the violence and the corruption that had always been a part of that power.
The court opens with the traditional reading of names, and the wide experience available to the bank is apparent.
Mr. Cobbold, Mr. Miners, Sir Charles Hambrough.
Senior Director, Merchant.
The bankers in the City of London had been at the very heart of the empire. In 1958, two of the most powerful of them, Lord Kindersley and William Keswick, were accused of using insider information to make millions for themselves.
Lord Kindersley.
Chairman of Rolls-Royce, merchant banker.
Mr. Keswick.
Hudson's Bay Company, a Far Eastern merchant.
The evidence against them was very strong. But when Keswick was shown the evidence, he dismissed it with a phrase that became notorious. It is difficult, he said, to remember conversations one has while shooting on a grouse moor.
And welcome back to the 35th annual Jerry Ford Palm Springs Desert Golf Rat Shoot. Well, the big surprise today, as we look up there at the leaderboard, is the sudden surge of presidential candidates among the front runners in the celebrity ranks. For a report on this phenomenon, at the ninth tee is Jack Rodenticus. Jack?
At the ninth tee with Ted Kennedy, sporting that thin mustache transplant, which I think makes him look very much like David Niven. His partner, Lee Trevino, just hit a very beautiful wood shot to the green, and now Kennedy is bending over the ball. There's that preppy backswing of his, so distinctive.
The shot's hooking! Oh, over the bridge and into the water! That's really a bad stroke for Mr. Kennedy. He's in trouble now. He'll have to dive for that ball, and he's talking it over with family and friends. He's waving his hand, waving away the advice of a lawyer. It looks like, yes, he will dive for the ball now and call the police in the morning. Ed?
Well, indications right here in the clubhouse are that this could eliminate Kennedy from the hunt. But let's go to Sam Norvegicus at the 16.
Ed, a really big rat has just poked his head out of the tumbleweed just 3 feet from where Ronald Reagan's chip shot lies for a very possible birdie here on the ultra-tough 16th. Reagan has called for a double O-gauge shotgun. That's the one he used in the Deadly Desert MGM 1939, but it's a rather unusual choice here on the 16th. Most pros would have gone after that rat with a knife, but of course Reagan's been in this tournament before, and looks like he overshot with that and wounded his caddy, California Lieutenant Governor Mike Kerb, who was bending over to pick up the ball. That must be painful, and it's going to be tough on the rulemakers here because I don't remember this ever happening before. Of course, lately, I don't seem to remember anything. Ed?
Well, you're right, Sam. Nothing like that has ever happened before. And Breen Prance that the rat was... No. Oh, wait a minute. Let's just go down to Bill Sumatra there on the 17th.
President Jimmy Carter trying to take his tee shot, and he'll have to take it on a dogleg right. This is the first time the president has set foot outside the White House since the many international crises that have dominated his attention. Except, of course, for those short, supervised, well-publicized trips to the bathroom. He's not going to play the shot? That is right. He's walking away from the tee. Must know something we do. Would you look at that? What a gorgeous move. He's smashed a rat flat that was hiding just behind a spectator. Smashed it flat.
Say,
well,
excuse
this
me,
will certainly
excuse
move
me for
him
interrupting,
yeah.
But back here on the ninth, Kennedy just shot an eagle.
Oh, well, that'll get him in trouble with environmentalists.
Yeah, but he used a fully automatic AR-14 on it.
That should be good with the NRA.
Definitely. I think so. So he's
gentlemen,
lost three.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Let's go down to Ben Bland on the 19th.
Ed, it's really bad here. Those six rats that Jerry Brown wouldn't kill, and they got out of his three-piece suit, and look at that, they're taking over the best seats of the bar, and they're telling all of Ronnie Reagan's jokes in advance. This could really...
Sorry to cut in, Ben, but that's all the time we have now.
A government inquiry said the two men were obviously innocent. the same time, reports had started to come back from one of the last parts of the empire, Kenya, that seemed to show that those in charge had gone out of control. They had been fighting a liberation movement called the Mau Mau. Reports said that hundreds of thousands of Kenyans had been put into special camps where they were going to be psychologically adjusted. The British were trying to manipulate what their chief psychologist called the African mind. But what then happened in the camps turned into a frenzied madness. The British used mass torture and killing as they desperately tried to hold on to power. The government in London denied all the accusations, but the rumours of violence and horror continued. And what had also not gone away was the fear and hatred inside the minds of many of the British, of the others.
It's candied apples and ponies with dapples, you can ride all day. It's girls with pimples and cripples with dimples that just won't go away. It's spicks and wops and niggers and kites with noses as long as your arm. It's micks and chinks and gooks and geeks and honkies who never left the farm.
The people the British had ruled over, who were now coming to what they had been told was the homeland.
Now listen carefully to this Indian's conversation with a white barber when he entered a saloon with a BBC radio microphone in his pocket.
No.
What's the matter?
No.
Anything wrong?
Yes.
Boss, what is it?
I said no.
Would I like to know what is the matter? Well, this is another half an hour yet.
I'm closed now.
But you're going to put the clothes on outside in the window, did you?
Well, you clear off.
Look, if you give me any reason why, what's with the matter, then I shall go if you to tell me.
I'm closed.
You're not closed. You're not closed. You're not closed yet.
Well, I am to you.
You've repeatedly said that you think capitalism played a role specifically in the epidemic of loneliness and alienation and effectively weakening the idea of the common good. Can you sort of develop that idea a little bit? How did that happen?
Well, let's begin by asking what capitalism is, because what capitalism is not at all what it purports to be. You know, if you ask most people, if you stop someone in the street and say, what's capitalism? Most people would quickly talk about trade. They would say, well, it's about buying and selling, and the person who makes money by selling something then invests that money so they can sell more stuff and then they can make more money, and on it goes. That's capitalism. But that's not at all how this thing we call capitalism has really worked. Quite the opposite, really. It's not been about trade. It's really been about theft on a grand scale. Look at how the United Kingdom became rich, or England and then Britain, as it was at the time. It was through bleeding India dry. We bled $45 trillion out of India. We taxed the subcontinent until there was virtually nothing left, then used a small amount of that tax money to buy its goods. So we were buying goods with their own money. And then we use the phenomenal profits, 100% profits, from that enterprise to finance the capture of other nations and the colonization of those nations and the cities and the railways and the other things we built in order to drain wealth out of them. And There are similar processes continuing today. If you sticking with the UK, if we look at a major source of our wealth, which is the City of London, much of that is based on laundering the money stolen from nations around the world. And this is a global entrepot for processing corruption. And this thing we call capitalism is actually looting. It's theft on a global scale.
Those who came from the Empire to Britain were shocked by the strange country they found. Michael de Freitas had come from Trinidad. He had grown up with a picture of a strong and confident homeland at the centre of the empire. Instead, what he found was what seemed to him a sad and frightened country.
You must remember that when we came to this country, we were not travelling to a foreign country. We were taught, I was taught when I was a young man, that my country, Trinidad, was an extension of this one. We were weaned on the concept of the empire. When I was a young boy, I stood in 90 degrees of sun, day after day, and sang all kind of silly things like God Save the Queen, Land of Hope and Glory, Britannia Rule the Waves, with the greatest of fervor, and believed every word of it. To come here and discover that not only wasn't I not traveling to the capital of the whole thing, which we were led to believe was so, but in actual fact we weren't wanted, has been a very shattering blow. Many people in this country who think that we are very hateful are so wrong.
You see, this is the great mystery. When you came here, you say you found you weren't wanted. Why then did you stay? Why did you choose to stay here?
This was the heartland of the whole thing. And one hoped, against hope, that what one saw was not right.
I said you're dead.
In America, the idea of individualism had become central to the politics of the Cold War.
What are you, bulletproof? Get out from behind that tree.
Because it was what defined the United States against the collective ideology of Russia. At the heart of it was the picture of a strong, confident individual living an independent life in the new giant suburbs outside the old cities.
My gun won't shoot that far.
But there was a weakness, because the people in the suburbs were alone. And in their isolation, away from the old communities, they started to become fearful and lost.
Straight people, terrifying their own children, living in a world only they can understand.
They'll bug you. They'll bug your mind.
The straight people.
You'll see them in breakfast nooks across the country, smoking cigarettes, drinking martinis, driving two cars.
The straight people.
You'll join them, hanging out at redemption centers, licking glue, making deals with total strangers.
The straight people will be inside their minds, as they say.
Anything more from the supermarket, honey?
More sugar!
The straight people. Now playing in Patio's and Carter Mounts from Paranoid Pictures.
This movie has been rated X the Unknown. Positively no one admitted.
Out of these fears came a paranoia that was fueled by groups on the extreme right, like the John Birch Society.
To the Republic, for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible.
They said that the American government had been taken over by hidden groups, controlled by the communists. And at the end of the 1950s, a theory spread like wildfire through the suburbs that President Eisenhower himself had really been put into power by the communists. He is a dedicated, conscious agent of the Russians, the head of the John Birch Society said. That conclusion is based on detailed evidence so extensive that it is beyond any reasonable doubt.
This is called Talking John Birch, Paranoid Blues.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what I was gonna do. The communists was coming around. They was in the air, they was on the ground, they was following me all over. I run down most hurriedly and joined the John Birch Society. Got me a secret membership card, started walking off down the road. Yee-hoo! I'm a real John Bircher now, look out. Now we all agree with Hitler's views, although he killed 6 million Jews, it don't matter too much that he was a fascist. At least you can't say he was a communist. That's a say like if you got a cold, take a shot of malaria. I was looking everywhere for them gall-darn reds. I got up in the morning, looked under my bed. Looked behind the kitchen and behind the door. Looked in the glove compartment of my car, couldn't find any. Looked behind the sink, behind the chair. I was looking for them reds everywhere. I looked way up my chimney hole, looked deep down inside my toilet bowl, I got away. I was sitting home alone and I started to sweat. I figured they was in my TV set. I peeked behind the picture frame, got a shock from my feet that hit me right up in the brain. Them reds did it. The hardcore one. Then I quit my job so I could work all alone, and I changed my name to Sherlock Holmes. Following some clues from my detective bag, I discovered there was red stripes in the American flag. Oh, Betsy Ross. Eisenhower, he's a Russian spy, Lincoln, Jefferson, and then a Roosevelt guy. To my knowledge, there's just one man that's really a true American, George Lincoln Rockwell. I know for a fact he hates commies because he picketed the movie Exodus. Well, I finally started thinking straight when I run out of things to investigate. I couldn't imagine anything else, now I'm home investigating myself. Hope I don't find out anything. Good God.
But this paranoia was not a new thing. An influential political scientist called Richard Hofstadter published an article that caused a sensation. He said that there had always been a dark paranoia built into America from the very start. The first settlers had come from Europe to America to flee from the corruption of power in the Old World. But although they had got away from the old power, they hadn't got away from their suspicious minds. And alone, out in the vast wilderness of the New America, that led them to imagining dark, hidden conspiracies in their own government, far away in Washington. One of the first of these, in the early 19th century, said that a secret group from Europe called the Bavarian Illuminati were running a giant conspiracy in America to destroy the new democracy.
Ladies and gentlemen, a short...
Get it on! Get it on!
A short historical piece brought to you by the Educated Educational People Society. A short play involving Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and a Mason. Thomas Jefferson speaks first to Benjamin Franklin.
Hey, let's invite over a bunch of immigrants and make cards.
Scene two. In the next scene, Ben Franklin is seen walking the streets in Philadelphia, pondering what his famous contemporary has said. Ben Franklin thinks,
I wonder what Tom, the old friend, was talking about.
That's fart, Ben, but let's move on. A Mason appears, wearing a business suit and a leather apron. He crosses his hands in front of the apron. Franklin stops and crosses his hands.
That's fart.
Fart. His fart in front of his suit, where his apron would be. Ben speaks.
More of your insane power games, eh?
The Mason does a complicated hand movement in front of the apron, then slaps Ben across the face with both hands really hard. Ben checks his nose for a break or a bleed. He takes a trowel out of his suit, and running the edge along his finger, he thrusts the trowel under the Mason's nose.
You're a dog, Illuminati, and a pain to meet on the streets of this basically clean town.
The Mason remains silent, having no lines, not in his face either. Ben faces him off as the shadows begin to change their perspective, and the cobblestones lose their morning warmth.
Now my feet are getting too clawed to change my mind.
That's cold, Ben.
Cold to change my mind.
Ben notices that his hand is bleeding viciously from the trowel cut on his finger.
Damn. I say, dammy, sir, I'm wounded. Clear, sir, and a good cut.
The Mason is asleep on his feet and motions in an unconscious way to his rival.
Well, sir, how many drops till I'm dead, sir? Must I become the color of the sunset, sir? Demi, sir. You bleed me white, sir. Demi, I say. And see and die, I die. Oh, God.
The Mason's face is ajar, like a baby's. In the way his cheeks turn up like a protective baby button and his eyes the color of sky blue sky and oatmeal. There is a ring pacifier at his lip, which Ben's best friend pulls, and the Mason's best friend speaks.
I wanted the woods and the Indians to sleep with me, but I was afraid of the cold and made them sleep outside, so I never felt the touch of a warm, naked Indian or in a cold, naked forest. I was lost and had only the steel I had to cut me forward. I am a little boy speaking like a man in a suit that squeezes on the parts that make me forget that I'm a little boy and I am not moving as I would like to be. I am standing still and the heavens are wheeling about me and the atmosphere and the moisture polarize each other so the colors are always changing and my sense of time is so acute that I can hear it. I will be free.
In reality, the Illuminati had been a utopian movement who wanted to replace religion with reason. But instead, they now became the first of a series of frightening suspicions that fed off the isolation of the settlers in the New World. The suburbs, Hofstadter said, is just part of a much larger darkness built into the very structure of America itself that was feeding, yet again, on people's separateness and isolation. But in the same suburbs, there was a new movement rising up that was going to confront and challenge these fears. It was driven by a radical individualism that said that you as an individual can shape the world the way you want it to be, not accept what the dark fears tell you it is.
Hello, Doctor. How are you?
The doctor is on.
Good, Doctor. Nice to see you operating.
Ha ha, that's very logical.
All right, Doc, this is it. Gird your grit for a big one. Why does the porridge bird lay his egg in the air?
No.
Why does perished birds leaves its hex in the air?
No.
Why is dove and perish barn's lazy leg in the ire?
No.
Why is ass the poor rich barn hong
delay
laser's edge in the fair?
No.
The doctor is unhappy.
Unhappy.
Is the doctor turned off?
No.
Well, if you're turned on, aren't you happy?
No.
Are you a machine that only answers no?
No.
Then you can answer a question yes.
Yes.
Can't you answer my question yes or no?
Yes.
No. Please choose, Doctor.
No shoes, Doctor.
No.
Ah, but you just did choose, Doctor.
No.
Doctor, you're lying.
Yes.
Excuse me, don't excuse me. Ah, Clem, you're making, not making the doctor unhappy, happy.
I'm not making the doctor anything. You're on, aren't you?
Yes.
Do you remember the past, Doctor?
Gypsy, yes. Doctor.
Do you remember the future?
Yes.
Forget it, Tim.
Don't forget it.
It would be one of the main foundations of the counterculture movement that was going to spread throughout the West. But now it was just beginning, born out of odd moments across the suburbs of California. One night, Kerry Thornley went with his friend Greg Hill to a bowling alley. They started to discuss reality. Thornley insisted that there was a fixed order to the universe. But Greg said that the universe was chaos, and it was human thought that projected an order onto the chaos.
Sitting around in a bowling alley in 1958, to be exact, somewhere in the vicinity of Whittier, California, and we were discussing philosophy, and we were talking about order and chaos. Greg's theory was that order was projected on the universe, that it didn't exist at all, that it was a creation of the human mind, that order was entirely in perception and had nothing to do with what was going on out there in a completely chaotic universe.
Thornley was inspired by this, and together, he and Greg Hill decided to set up a movement dedicated to the idea of chaos. They called it Discordianism. Underlying it was the belief that individuals had the power inside themselves to bring order and meaning to the chaos. Not the old systems of power that created the fear and suspicion. But then, an extraordinary coincidence happened that was going to lead Thornley back towards that darkness in America. Thornley was sent to do service with the Marines. And at the camp, he met another recruit who seemed to embody the figure of the free, independent individual he so admired, because he refused to bow to the power of the officers. He was called Lee Harvey Oswald. And they became close friends. Thornley had read the novels of Ayn Rand, and he decided he was going to write a novel with Oswald as the central figure, a hero of this new age. But then suddenly, Oswald defected to the Soviet Union, and things became very strange. It seemed that the reality outside was even more chaotic than he had imagined.
It was really a weird experience for me, because I was writing this novel based on Oswald. When Oswald defected to the Soviet Union, I decided to write a novel about a Marine who becomes disenchanted with the U.S. and goes to the Soviet Union. And so it was like the hero, and I didn't like Kennedy. I was extremely anti-Kennedy myself, because I was so much into Ayn Rand, the laissez-faire capitalism, objectivism. And Kennedy was the arch villain of our movement at that time. And it was like the hero of my novel jumped up off the pages of my book and shot the president. And it was very weird.
Michael De Freitas was now working for a notorious landlord in Notting Hill called Peter Rackman. Rackman owned hundreds of flats in decaying houses in Notting Hill, which he rented out to prostitutes and immigrants. De Freitas' job was to be Rackman's enforcer, often using threats and violence, including breaking in and wrecking the flats.
When we come back in the night, we see everything outside. All the floor mash up, all the wardrobe, all the chair, all the table, all the clothes on the floor, dirty. He take my brother's tools and mash up all the floor, pull up all the light. No water. I say, well.
Michael De Freitas was fascinated by his new employer, because Peter Rackman was far more than just the brutal gangster that he was portrayed as. He had lived an extraordinary life. He had been born in Lvov, on the border of Ukraine and Poland. Then the Nazis invaded, and Rackman was arrested and forcibly sterilized because he was Jewish. But he managed to escape. He fled into Russia, but was captured again, this time by the Russians, who sent him to the labor camps in Siberia, where he watched people survive by killing each other and then eating the human flesh.
Oh, that laser beam nearly made optical weenies out of me. I gotta get moving. Hey, I am moving. It's cold here.
Ooh. Hey, come on over by the fire, stranger.
You talking to me?
And lost.
I am.
Sit on the spit.
Thanks a lot.
Make yourself to home. This here's the end of the road, right?
Sure is.
This here is Donna's Pass.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, too bad Donna passed on. We just entered. He just passed her.
Wait a minute.
An eating chair works up an appetite. Uh-huh. Nice to have you for dinner, cuz.
What?
You're it.
Hey, get your teeth out of my bridge. Hey, let me out of here! Hark, Mark!
Help! Help me! Help me!
But then the Nazis invaded Russia. And suddenly, Rackman became Russia's ally. He was sent off to fight with the Free Polish Army. And he ended up, after the war, in London, stateless, and a complete outsider. That horror meant that Rackman judged nobody. For him, the differences between right and wrong were luxuries for the privileged. In the face of horror, everyone was the same, focused entirely on survival. But the English judged him. He was hated with an overwhelming disgust as the face of evil. De Freitas believed that this revealed something that was hidden in English society.
We start with the story of a man. Let me say straight away, a sordid story that some of you may well not want the younger children to hear. This is Peter Rackman, one of Britain's big-time 20th century racketeers.
On the surface, there was the overt racism against the immigrants that Rackman was bringing into Notting Hill.
A large number of people of Notting Hill are trying to mix the two races, are trying to bring about a coffee-coloured mulatto population in Britain, then I regard it as no disgrace with the White Defence League to come on the scene and stand up for white interests.
But De Freitas saw something deeper. Rackman's property empire was a brutal and violent one, but it was doing something that polite English society completely refused to do. He was giving people on the very margins of society, prostitutes and black immigrants, somewhere to live. His empire shone a harsh light on the hypocrisy of the nice people at the top of English society, who would never think of themselves as racist, but wanted nothing to do with the people he was moving into Notting Hill. And they hated him for it.
Into town kinda late one night, looked like everything was closed up tight. I've been driving hard and I needed to unwind. I spotted this joint down a lonely street. I needed a drink or maybe something to eat, so I never noticed the words up on that sign. By the next thing you know, I was flat on my back, two drinks in each hand. I was under attack from a beautiful girl who held on to me tight. I grabbed my wallet, said, man, don't fight, you paid your money, you got all night to wrestle a nude live stewardess in flight. Mm. Oh.
hide what she had on. Didn't keep on no light, she was nude as a proud bird. Oh, wearing a cute little hat. I said, good God, honey, I got to go. There's a woman waiting who loves me so. She said, ease back, son, just don't step out that door. Well, it's a good thing I didn't, cause it would have been over. We was flying high and I got real sober. At 1,000 feet, we was heading for the unknown. That's right, that taught everybody inside was airborne. I mean, we was going for a ride and everybody seemed to be having more fun than me. You could hear it. So I told myself, well, relax, what else could I do? I grabbed me two girls and a bottle of booze and I eased back to where that party was really going on. I was looking for the pilot to ask him a question. None of these swingers knew our destination. Then I noticed that the man behind the bar had horns and a tail. Well, I shouted, good Lord, then I wish I hadn't said it. If I had one brain, them people could have read it. And the man behind the bar, well, his tail began to twitch. Conversation stopped, so did the loving. I was scared to death. It was hot like an oven, and some of them big old boys was a-pulling knives. Switchblade pitchforks, demon pig stickers.
This was captured in an interview that the BBC did with the local upmarket journalists in Notting Hill about the day Rackman visited their offices.
What struck me about him was his extraordinary sense of being so evil. This was a really evil man. We'd heard a lot about Rackman, and finally here he was sitting in this room. But I don't think any of us were prepared to see such a grotesque individual, kind of gravelly type of voice, a sort of almost a diseased voice, if you like, the kind of thing which went, oh, Mrs. Denny, what do you want to see me for? I mean, I've done nothing.
De Freitas decided that there was a fear in England that went far deeper than just the working class racism. That behind the polite veneer of the middle classes, there was a hard ruthlessness and a suspicion of others. De Freitas gave it a name. He called it Englishism.
London. They walk again by night, out of the fog and into the smog. Relentlessly, ruthlessly.
I wonder where Ruth is.
Doggedly. Toward their naughty meeting with the unknown. At Piccadilly Circus, they turn left.
Hey, you're driving on the wrong side! Hey, you're driving on the wrong side of the road!
Back her off, Yank!
They cross Hyde Park to get their fair share of abuse and walk into a great marble arch.
Oh, my nose!
Groping for the door, they step inside and make their way through the crowded pub. They climb the 13 steps to the tiny stage. They're ready for mystery. They're ready for excitement. They're ready to affect phony British accents.
Because
we're
the Fire Sign Theatre!
It came, he said, from both an anger and a melancholy at the loss of their empire. Then Peter Rackman died of a heart attack. And Michael De Freitas suddenly found that he was the new face of evil.